Good evening and a greeting in Jesus' name again this evening. Good to be with you here again. I'm sure at this time of the second week, you're probably already sick of sitting and listening. And here we go again. Can we learn anything tonight? I can tell just in the couple days I've been here that the students are getting more familiar with each other, and I kind of remember that from Bible school. It seems like the noise level at the end of the second week, it just really starts to climb. So I'm glad you're enjoying yourself, getting to know each other, and that's a big blessing, part of Bible school. Make new friends. It'll last a lifetime if you treat them right. I'm entitled the message tonight, Alone on the Wall. Alone on the Wall. We've got two verses from Ecclesiastes 4, verse 9 and 10, I'd like to look at. They say, two are better than one, because they have a good reward for their labor. For if they fall, the one will lift up his fellow. But woe to him that is alone when he falleth, for he hath not another to help him up. If you look at my screensaver on my little computer that I brought with, it's a picture of a mountain. And I can't quite tell. I like to look at pictures of mountains and guess where they're from. Okay? You can actually, seems like you can make a lot of progress. The vegetation is kind of the same. Often the pictures and calendars and magazines, etc., are taken from a perspective that you can often kind of tell where a mountain is. I think the one on my computer screen is, it must be taken in Antarctica or somewhere like that, somewhere where there's big rock and lots of glaciers. And maybe I have too wild of imagination, but a while ago I just was looking at the rock and just looking at the mountain, and it's a picture of a cliff, and the cliffs you can see a ways away, perhaps maybe a mile away, and they wrap around, and it comes around in the picture until it almost looks like you're standing on a cliff. And I got to looking at that, and I realized the position I was in, if I was in this picture, and I realized how high I was, and I got just a little bit of a queasy feeling just looking at that screensaver. I was so far up on this mountain. I've always been interested in mountain climbing, and I've enjoyed those stories, especially if they're true. I love true stories of men's battle with the elements. Rescue type of stories, search and rescue. And I've been interested in mountain climbing. I remember my dad, when I was very little, he had a little home video camera, and he went and climbed two mountains in southern Alberta there, Square Chief and Crow's Nest Mountain, if any of you know where that is. He climbed those and videoed it, and he had pictures of that group as they slid down the mountain on those big slides of snow, and extremely unsafe, but it was really entertaining pictures, and you could run it backwards, and they'd go back up the hill. That was really neat. I remember watching that as a young man, and this idea of mountain climbing has always really been part of my life. I don't know what you think about when you think of mountain climbing. I don't know which mountains you think. Perhaps you think of the big mountains like Everest or K2 or Annapurna, those big months-long assaults on a mountain, high altitude and very little oxygen, and those climbs are more of an endurance attempt against the mountain. I'd like to tell the story of a little different kind of a mountain climber tonight. I'd like to tell you the story of a mountain climber named Alex Honnold. Does anybody recognize that name? Alex Honnold. All right, well, this man, he's a very interesting man. He's actually born in 1985. Very contemporary of ours, and his home is in Sacramento, Central California there, and he's been a climber since he was seven, and he's climbed all his life, and he's good at it, and he has that kind of a skinny frame with long arms and obviously very good shape, and he's tough, and his friends have a nickname for him. His nickname is No Big Deal. That's his nickname, No Big Deal. And that has to do with his attitude as he climbs, his nonchalance and his, you know, that persona he puts out as he's climbing, his laid-back way of living. You know, Alex climbs all over the world, but he's not a big endurance mountain climber like Everest. He's a rock wall climber. Rock wall, big rock walls, just big cliffs is what he likes to climb. Big slabs of rock all over the world. And probably, as I understand it, the center for the big rock wall climbing community in the world, if you're into that extreme sport, is right there in Yosemite National Park, not far from Alex's home. And you've seen the kind of places where Alex climbs. He climbs those cliffhanger type pictures where people are hanging by their hands, and you see the ropes and they're seemingly impossible pasted onto this rock hundreds of feet in the air. And there they are, and it's impressive climbing, and it's a fear control in the extreme as they climb those impressive mountains. Take, for instance, the mountain of Half Dome. Does anybody recognize that name, the mountain Half Dome? Okay, they're in Yosemite. What it is a big old, think of an igloo, huge igloo of rock that's cut in half. And there's just one side and the back side around. It's called a half dome. And the front side is a sheer cliff. And the cliff is somewhere around 2,200 feet high. 2,200 feet. And this, just some early history on the climbing of this mountain, this cliff was first climbed in 1957, is when it was climbed. And this is some early history. All of the major walls and formations in Yosemite Valley had been climbed by the mid-1950s, with the exception of the northwest face of Half Dome and El Capitan. That's another mountain there. El Capitan, with its intimidating 3,000-foot face, was obviously out of the question for at least a few years, leaving Half Dome with a much more manageable 2,200-foot face as the logical next goal. The first attempt to climb it was made in 1954 by three men, Dick Long, Jim Wilson, and George Mandatory. However, they only managed to climb 175 feet before retreating. A more serious attempt to find passage up this cliff was made in 1955 by four men, Jerry Galawas, Don Wilson, Royal Robbins, and Warren Honding. After climbing a mere 500 feet, over 5 days, this party too retreated. Galawas and Robbins, armed with new chrome molybdenum pitons made by Galawas, recruited another man, Mike, and they set off on January 24, 1957, determined to finish this route. Over a period of 5 days, they encountered repeated obstacles, and using ingenuity and tenacity, they surmounted all of these difficulties. 5 days after they had left the ground, they stood at the mountain, at the summit of the mountain. It took them 5 days in 1957, the first time that rock wall was climbed. And this climbing, obviously, as you can read from this story, is very, very technical and difficult. They're climbing a smooth granite rock face on some very, very thin holds, very, very skimpy handholds. And they have to put their fingers, just the edges of their fingers, on these little flakes of rock, and they have to stick their fingers in just a little tiny crack. Just the tips of the finger will go in sometimes, and then turn their hand, and that gives the friction. And they carry bags of chalk to dry the sweat off their hands as they're climbing these rock walls. Overhangs, long reaches, they can barely reach to. Sometimes they have to jump to try to get another handhold. Sometimes they have to use their feet, lift their feet way up and put their heel up to get some leverage, to gain some elevation on this mountain. And all the while they're hugging this wall, just sheer face. And just below them, air for hundreds of feet. Nothing. Nothing behind them. They wear rubber shoes, thin rubber shoes that allow for a lot of contact with their feet on the ground. And you can imagine this is a very touch-and-go process. A lot of courage involved in this kind of rock climbing. A lot of tenacity. And you can imagine that they're scared. And so they stay alive. To stay alive, they use ropes and a harness and bolts to stay on that rock wall. And as they climb, they insert bolts into the rock. And basically what that is a concrete wedge anchor. You know what that is, where you drill a hole, you put a bolt in, a little wedge on it, You screw a nut on there and the bolt can't come out because the wedge expands out against the side of the hole. And so they're using these, and they put a bolt in the rock and they put a little clip on there that they can hook the rope on. And now they got a bolt and a rope on the rock and they're fastened on there. And so they go up this rock wall with these bolts. They drill a hole, put a bolt in, clip the rope through the bolt, and somebody stands below them holding the bottom of the rope, letting out slack, and they try to climb a little more. Put another bolt in and climb up this rock face. So they use bolts. And they try to place the bolts to limit the distance that they would fall when they slip off. And the rope would catch them on the bolt and the clip there. And believe it or not, they fall a fair amount. In fact, they have falling techniques. They get good at falling. They learn how to fall and to fall safely. And they work as a team, and they put the lead climber on belay, and they watch him, and they spot for him and tell him where to reach. And when he falls off, they grab the rope, and their weight in their harness lifts them up and saves him as he falls. They also tie into more than one anchor, so if one pulls out, they have a backup plan. And typically anymore, these routes are outlined, and the bolts have been placed, and people use the same route. And if you're a climbing fanatic, you know who put the route up there, and how many people have been up, and how good it works. You know all these things about if you're in the climbing world. And in this world of big wall, solid rock climbing, Alex Honnold is a superstar. He is a man that stands out. And when you listen to the testimony and the voice of his peers, you can hear the worship in their voices. And it's even more impressive when you realize that these friends are hardened mountain climbing risk takers themselves. When they talk about Alex Honnold, they just get a little quiet. Because in the world of climbing, there are different styles. And I've been describing one style of climbing with bolts and ropes and climbing. There's another style of climbing called free climbing. And this idea is you use the ropes and the gear as a safety net, but you do not lean on the ropes. You don't take the weight with the rope. It's simply to save your life in case of a fall. And so if you're a free climbing purist, if you end up hanging on the rope, and you're going to actually get credit for doing this climb, you got to go to the bottom and start over. You don't get to hang on the rope. And then there's the kind of climbing that Alex does. And Alex is a free solo climber. A free solo climber. That's the term they use. And what that means is that you go alone. And you go without gear. No bolts, no harness, no ropes, no backup plan, no recourse in the event of a mistake, nothing, and nobody. And he climbs these walls alone with that amount of gear. And Alex Honnold, too, climbed the northwest face of Half Dome. But it didn't take him 5 days. It took him 2 hours and 50 minutes of intense physical exertion, intense mind control. And I'm kind of a conservative individual when it comes to risk-taking. That sounds to me like way out there. And to think, and they got pictures of him during this climb. And at one point he's standing there on his ledge with his back to the wall, and the ledge is probably about this wide. And at that occasion he almost ran out of courage. There he was with his back to the wall, and just the valley floor just hundreds of feet below him. And just this sheer face above him. and nothing and nobody to help. He's alone on that wall. Just to make it totally clear, in some ways Alex is not playing quite fair to that picture. Because Alex climbs all the routes that he wants to freeze solo. He climbs them ahead of time. And he makes sure he knows that he can do it. And he makes sure he knows where the handholds are. And Alex never climbs in bad weather. And Alex never climbs if the wind's blowing too hard. And he don't freeze solo in the dark. And he knows where the holds are. And he goes up, and as he goes ahead of time, he cleans it. And makes sure the rock is solid. And he goes up on ropes. And he takes a little brush and cleans out the crevasses where dirt may have been. So he can get just a little better hold on this rock. So he spends that kind of effort on a 2,200-foot face that he's going to go up. And he never free solos a route unless he's absolutely sure he knows he can make it. That's what he says. And Alex describes himself as a militant atheist. That's what he would call himself. And he'll sit there in the quiet of the Yosemite Meadow, and he'll tell you in a calm voice that it's just one slip, one mistake, and it's all over. No miracles, no second chances, no going back, no reset button on his video game of life. Just 4 seconds of free fall and a very sudden stop. And nothing, no hope, no future, no eternity. And that's what he believes. And he counts the cost and he takes the chance. And even with all the precautions he takes as a free soloist, he breathes a very rare air of an elite group of climbers. Because free soloists make up, as you can imagine, less than 1% of all the people that are out there climbing on steep rock walls. Less than 1%. It's just too dangerous. It's just too dangerous. Now that was the parable. We didn't come here tonight to talk about rock climbing necessarily. And I've got some truths that I'd like to take from that picture tonight that I think have deep implications for how you intend to live your Christian life. Because it wasn't that long ago that I was sitting where you are, and there were others sitting with me. And I'm not that old, but I believe for the most part the group gathered here tonight will in one way or another spend their lives in the church as we know it, or out there on their own in some kind of a near field orbit of some kind of a church, a group of people. And they're out there on their own and they'll face the danger of the spirit world alone. And so I'd like to look at that picture of the rock wall climbing as Alex does it. And think about your spiritual life and our spiritual journey. I'd like you to consider what it's like to be alone on the wall. And in my picture, the big rock wall is our Christian life. And we're climbing our way to heaven. And it's every Christian's mandate to climb the wall. You've got to make it. And the known routes to the top are the faithful lives of those that have gone before in history. And they've made it. And the bolts in the rock are the positions held by successful climbers of the past. And the ropes that the climbers use are our positions, our standards, our unity. They tie us together and they keep us from falling. And our fellow climbers are other Christians in the church. And it's interesting to me that Alex's peers, very few will do what he's doing because it's so dangerous. How strange then that as we pivot from that picture of the real world and the rock wall, the hard rock wall, and we look at the dangers in the landscape of a spiritual life as you climb, that the numbers of free soloists are almost in reverse. Because it seems like the children of that generation are wiser than the children of light. Because his fellow climbers can look at that wall and said, that's too dangerous. But somehow Christians can look at an equally impossible task and say, I'm going to try that. I think I can do that. And they set out. As we think about our Christian life, I've just got a few simple points from this message. The first one I'd like to point out is that we choose our climbing style. That's the choice you make. And you may make it by default. You may make it by ignoring it. But nevertheless, it's a choice you make. What kind of climbing style you're going to use? And in the Christian, in that world, in this world, climbing alone is incredibly risky, as we pointed out. Because if you are alone, you must be all-sufficient. You've got to have it in within yourself to make it. If you're alone, you cannot be weak. You can't be weak. The weak don't climb the wall, I guess, in freestyle soloing Christianity. If you're alone, you must be able to handle every situation alone, on your own. If you're alone, you cannot afford any mistakes. No mistakes. Climbing alone is inherently selfish. Because you're only concerned about you. And whether or not you make it. And it's somebody else's problem if they ain't strong enough to do this. And I'll see you in heaven if you make it. And climbing alone is selfish. You know, climbing with a group, if you're going to climb with the ropes, if you're going to climb with friends, you know, it requires some sacrifice. Remember, this is a spiritual picture that we're building here. If you're going to climb with friends, it's going to take some sacrifice. You know what? You're going to have to tarry one for another. You're going to have to wait on each other. And you can't set some speed record to heaven all by yourself. If you're going to climb with a group, you've got to be prepared to help the weak ones, the hurt ones, those that aren't quite as strong as you are. You've got to be prepared to help. And to climb with others, you got to be willing to take your turn, holding on the rope, and making sure somebody else stays safe in his climb to heaven. You know, if you're going to climb with a group, you must come to some kind of agreement on the route that you're going to take. Because if you're on the same rope, you can't go two ways. You've got to be able to come to an agreement. That's a sacrifice you must make if you're going to climb with a group. And there's, as we pointed out, many benefits to climbing with a group. Climbing with a group, you can lean on someone else's strengths and talents. You can lean on somebody else's abilities, on their insights, on their picture that they can see that you can't. But then you got to climb with a group. And the third point I'd like to make tonight is we choose how we feel about the bolts and the ropes. You know, that too is a choice that we make. And there's nobody telling Alex's friends that they must take bolts and ropes on their climbs. But they do it because they want to. And they recognize the benefits of using those tools. And so we make the choice of how we feel about what it takes to work within the bounds of our group. And climbers accept the inconvenience of the rope. And they got to pack that thing, and they got to keep it from getting tangled. They got to carry it extra weight. And they accept all those things in exchange for the safety that they offer. They accept the ropes because it connects them to the help that's at the other end of the rope. And somebody's over there, and if I get in trouble, he'll save my life. You know, climbers insist on correct rope etiquette. You don't just tie any old knot. You don't just hook your ropes up any old way. And you've got to get this right, and you don't tangle it, and you wrap it up the right way. These ropes matter, and how you deal with them if you're a climber. You know, an interesting thing about a climber and his rope is he can voluntarily unhook that rope at any time. He's got a little clip on his harness. You just pop that thing open, and you're off. And you're free. You can stand there, free. And it's 2,000 feet to the bottom. And you picture yourself on that cliff. And you just unclip that rope. And you don't need that thing. You can't stand here. You know, you don't feel very free on that rock wall. Because it's so far down. And you'll be going so fast when you hit the bottom. But it's a choice they make, how they feel about that. Choice they make. Is it worth the effort? Is it a waste of my time? Is this a burden? Or is this something that's going to make sure that I make it? Climbers tie off on the bolts for a reason. You know, that bolt represents a solid spot. Some kind of anchor. That's what it is. It's an anchor, something to hang on to. An otherwise very slippery and hazardous and broken scene. You know, when climbers come across a bolt on the rock wall, you know what? They know somebody was there before them. And somebody put this root up there. And for some reason, that guy in his success to the top thought that this was a good spot. I'm going to tie in right here. And he took that position and he held it. And it worked for him. And it was an anchor. It was a success. You know, I personally believe if I'm referring to these bolts in my picture today as the positions and the traditions of the church that has gone before, I don't think there's something wrong with making slight adjustments and putting a new bolt in at a slightly different spot. And I'm not condemning whoever put that first bolt in. And you know, He might have been climbing in the bright sunshine on a clear day. And the bolt made sense right there. And it might be snowing and the wind's blowing where I'm climbing. And the pressure's coming from a different angle. And so I need to move my bolt just a little bit. But I've got a bolt on the rock. And I know where I stand. And the position I take, and it's an anchor. Do you think those climbers, as they're climbing, they show disdain for these bolts as they go up past them? You know, I suppose they inspect them pretty carefully. You know, because finally, they're put in a long time ago, some of them. And it's a long ways to the bottom. You know, climbers don't unhook from these bolts simply because the position makes them uncomfortable. And you know, climbing these mountains, as you can imagine, is a very uncomfortable thing to do. And you know, their hands on that rock wall and their fingernails and to cram your fingers in those cracks and to jam your foot in a crack to get some leverage. And the flexing that's required, you know, they really get beat up on that rough granite surface. And so they put in a bolt sometimes, and they're in a position, and perhaps it's in an overhang, and this bolt makes me uncomfortable where I'm at. Just because they're uncomfortable, they don't unhook from the bolts. The climbers don't. You know, they don't unhook from the bolt until they've hooked into a better one. Or one closer to the top. And that's when they'll make the change. The climber's bolts are not the enemy. So friends, tonight, you'll never free solo into heaven. God never designed men to live the Christian life alone. The New Testament takes for granted that any Christian that is truly a Christian will find himself an integral part of a local body with a life-changing regard for how they feel about his life. And by that mean, he will make the adjustments necessary to be part of the team and to hang on to the rope and to live a life of success and to help the weak and to wait for the tired and carry those that are incapable themselves. And see, young lady, when he's coming around and he's asking for your attention, and he's talking free solo, and he's living a no big deal Christian life, and his concepts are free solo, and he's picking routes, and he's got a plan, and he don't need anybody else. You know, the alarms better go off for you. And you tell him that you're no fool. Because the rocks below are littered with spiritual corpses of men just like him. And there is nothing new under the sun. And you tell him you're not interested. And he can move right along. You know, Alex Honnold's friends hold him in reverence in their idolatry. But behind this awe that you hear when they talk about him, I find this underlying edge of uncertainty. When they think about Alex, when they talk about him, they consider what he's doing. And if they're honest, that in spite of his impressive accomplishments, I believe that to a man, when they get the call that he's missing, and he slipped, and the rock broke in his hand, and it was an unfortunate accident. And the 4 seconds of free fall are over. Not one single person of his friends will be surprised. And you can hear it in their talk. They're not going to be surprised. It's that dangerous. Because Ecclesiastes 4:10 said, "For if they fall, the one will lift up his fellow. But woe to him that is alone when he falleth." And you see in that a prediction and a prophecy and a law of God. You know, Jesus is the only one that can make a perfect ascent. Woe to him that is alone when he falleth. You know, I don't know where this message finds you in your spiritual life tonight. You know, I don't know if you hate the ropes. I don't know if you hate the bolts. I don't know if you've despised the weak and you don't like the baggage of waiting for these old people to get something done. And perhaps you've just simply unhooked from the rope. And you show up at church, you sit on the back bench, but you're free. And maybe you've taken that step back and you look up. And this rock wall just goes up. And you're picking on a route. And you're going to do it yourself. Woe to him that is alone when he falls. I'd like to bow our heads for prayer.